Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The violent political revolt in Ukraine has stabilized in Kiev as it intensifies in Crimea. We have our foreign correspondent Michael Petru on the ground in Ukraine to give us the latest on this tense and fragile situation.
We're recording this week from the Manning Conference in Ottawa. We speak with Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall and former Cabinet Minister and current Chair of the Manning Center, Chuck Strahl. And Canada's big city mayors gather in Ottawa looking for more funding for affordable housing and infrastructure projects. But Rob Ford creates a media sideshow. We speak with Calgary Mayor Naheed Nenshi.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. This week, Aaron and I are broadcasting from the Manning Center Conference in Ottawa. Tories from across Canada gather once a year to discuss current issues facing the right wing and the future of conservatism in Canada. We'll bring you the latest from the conference floor later, but first, we're going to turn the spotlight onto the violence and political upheaval in Ukraine. As an interim government takes over in Kiev, ousted President Viktor Yanukovych speaks for the first time since fleeing the country. He remains defiant, insisting he is still the country's legitimate leader and saying he will continue to fight for the future of Ukraine.
Meanwhile, Canada sent a delegation to Ukraine to help support the new government. And Prime Minister Stephen Harper is now echoing our allies and saying all countries in the region should respect Ukraine's territory.
We remain very supportive of the Ukrainian people and their desire for democracy and a better future. And given developments that we see that are worrying to us, I think it is important that as Canadians we emphasize our very strong support.
That follows reports that Russian troops have taken up positions around a Coast Guard base and two airports in Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru is on the ground in Kiev. He joins us now by phone.
Well, I just arrived in Kiev. I just spent the last 2 days in the Crimea, in Sevastopol, the old Russian and current Russian seaport for the Black Sea Naval Flight. This is Simferopol, the regional capital. And the local parliament, the Crimean parliament, was stormed early this morning or late last night by armed men who still occupy it. Now, these are pro-Russian supporters. So, in other words, this is kind of like a mirror image of what was happening in Kiev in the Maidan earlier on. These are people that want closer ties to Russia, perhaps full independence. And according to a witness we spoke with who was there when the assault took place, they were armed with Kalashnikovs, other weapons, and used flash grenades to get inside the building. And they've occupied it now. So they have a Russian flag is now flying from the top of the Crimean Parliament. And outside the Crimean Parliament is a large number of quite happy pro-Russian supporters. So that mood in Crimea is very different than the mood here in Kiev, which I think is the crux of the challenge that Ukraine is going to face in the weeks ahead. Here in Kiev, in the capital, we have a new government, a new president. We have a successful revolution by all appearances. In Crimea, things are a lot more complicated. There's a large pro-Russian population there. But even within Crimea, there is also a population of Tatars, an ethnic and religious minority in Crimea, that are quite supportive of the new government in Kiev, and those two groups, the Tatars and the pro-Russians, have been clashing as well. So things are quite nervous, but still satisfied in Kiev, and entirely different in Crimea.
Does the focus now move to Crimea? Is the situation in Kiev sort of stable enough that the emphasis, the focus now needs to move to Crimea, or is this really almost a two-front issue?
Well, I think what's happening in Crimea, I guess, is the most immediate danger in terms of the fears of further violence or clashes or everyone's, you know, I guess, ultimate scenario would involve intervention from Russia. But the new government in Kiev has enormous problems as well and enormous challenges. The economy is in a mess. The politics are still in limbo. We have this new interim government. So I think the sort of, like, potential for street violence is very real in Crimea, although I must say today it was interesting that the Tatars were nowhere to be seen. I think they had vacated the parliament precisely to avoid violent clashes. So I think the sort of, you know, street-level violence is a possibility, and much worse is a possibility in Crimea. But the larger kind of macro challenges of starting a government from zero and really kind of rebuilding a country is what the new government in Kiev is faced with. And those challenges, if not quite as, you know, visually arresting, are no less
are no less severe.
How big is the threat, do you think, at this point of Russian intervention?
I don't think Russia will, personally. I'd hate to be proven wrong on that. I mean, Russia has entered into agreement to preserve the territorial integrity of Ukraine. I think it would just be an enormous, it'd be the invasion of a sovereign country. I don't think Russia will do that. That said, they're certainly given a lot of signs to suggest that they might. Everything from the military exercises along the border, they've been scrambling jet fighters, they've been making provocative statements. And, of course, their Black Sea fleet is moored in Sevastopol in Crimea. So I think my personal belief, and again, I could be wrong, and I hope I'm not, is that they're trying to shake up the new government in Kiev to remind them of their influence in Ukraine and to, I guess, plant the seeds for that further relationship. That said, Russia does have serious interest in Ukraine. The Black Sea fleet, above all else, although I don't think the new government in Kiev would be foolish enough to risk provoking Russia by jeopardizing that fleet's relationship. And they also have strong cultural ties to Ukraine. There are many people with Russian background here, Russian speakers here, people that feel a kinship to Russia. And Putin, I think on a personal level, feels very much that Ukraine is essentially a lost province. He once told George W. Bush that Ukraine is not even a state. So he feels that Ukraine is really just kind of an extension of Russia. So there are those reasons that would suggest that Russia feels that sort of emotional, and the Kremlin feels that emotional attachment to Ukraine. There are those very real strategic political reasons to keep Russia tied to Ukraine. But at the moment, I tentatively and cautiously predict that I don't think Russia would do anything as severe as an armed intervention.
What exactly can Canada do? What can the international community do? Sort of what is their role in all this?
Well, I hope to be speaking to some Ukrainian ministers and finding out their perspective. I mean, from the domestic political angle, of course, Canada has an interest in the Canadian government has this large Ukrainian diaspora in Canada, which I think the government is aware of, to say the least. But Canada is also seen as an ally, not as close by any means as, say, Poland or some other nations in the European Union, and not as powerful as the United States. But this larger struggle in Ukraine was triggered, we have to remember, by Ukraine rejecting an association agreement with the European Union in favor of closer ties with Russia. So Canada is part of the so-called West, which is tugging Ukraine in one direction. Now, that said, I think that simplifies things a lot. For a lot of Ukrainian protesters that I've spoken with, they say, look, it was never about wanting to be, more like France or Germany. What the European Union would do, or what closer ties to the European Union would do, would be to force Ukraine to adopt rules and regulations and political mores that would erode the corruption and the inefficient, poor government, abuses of human rights, that sort of thing going on in Ukraine. So the association agreement with Europe was always a tool, was always a means to another end. I mean, that said, Canada is still part of this, is seen as being part of this European or Western world where those sort of values and political norms are more established and therefore has perhaps something to share with Ukraine. And of course, I mean, I should be very clear, an awful lot of money. I mean, what the new Ukrainian government wants and needs, say they need, is financial relief. So I suspect that will be the ask from the new government, and I suspect the Canadian delegation is politically astute enough to probably offer some of that when they're here.
You've, in your career, been in tumultuous situations, in difficult situations for countries. Where, how would you describe the feeling in Ukraine, and how would you describe sort of your own sort of sense of where this is going? Is this, at the risk of oversimplifying, do you think this is headed in a right direction? In do you have any hope for the future?
I think enormous challenges lie ahead. I mean, we have to remember only a few days ago, or I guess last Wednesday and Thursday, close to 100 people died in a very, you know, concentrated area of the city. I mean, there was a lot of blood and a lot of death. And that gives a sense of enormous, beyond the personal tragedy, that creates a collective sense of sacrifice for this new political project here. And I think there's a certain amount of celebration, but as one lady said, it's a partial celebration. I mean, the real celebration, the real victory will be when, you know, a new government is established. So I think that there's, and often we feel the same thing in Egypt, there's a certain sense of jubilation when the immediate goal of a revolution is achieved, you know, in this case, the departure of Yanukovych. But now there's these challenges. I mean, what, you know, Crimea, holding the country together, holding Crimea as part of Ukraine, dealing with the enormous financial mess that it's in. I mean, I think most Ukrainians that I've spoken with are optimistic. On a personal level, I'm optimistic as well. I think things look better in Ukraine today than they did 2 months ago or even 2 weeks ago. That said, I mean, I expect difficult days ahead for Ukraine. I suspect a certain amount of disorder probably in the months ahead. I mean, this is not going to be an easy transition, even given everything that's been accomplished so far.
McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru joining us from Kiev to discuss the political revolt in Ukraine.
Coming up, we speak with Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall and delve deeper into the politics of the Manning Networking Conference.
We're here on the floor of the Manning Conference, where conservatives from across the country have gathered to discuss everything from jobs and the economy to political training to the state of the conservative movement.
The first main address of the conference came from Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall, whose speech is entitled Canada, Food and Energy Superpower. McLean's political editor Paul Wells sits down with Premier Wall to discuss his message to delegates and his future in politics.
Premier Wall, thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Is it an odd thing for a provincial premier to come and speak to a national conference about national issues? And did you have any, did you spend any time trying to figure out what you would say, or does that come automatically?
Well, we have a number of messages that we stick with in the province, our growth agenda. And very specifically, we often talk about the future of our province being tied to the hope that our country and Saskatchewan can take advantage of the fact, as I said today, that the fastest growing economies in the world, principally in Asia, they need food security and energy security. This is what they prize. And in that world, I like Saskatchewan's chances. We should like Canada's chances because we don't talk a lot about food production and agriculture. We should, because I went through the stats today. Our numbers are prolific and our opportunity to increase is great through research. And, of course, in energy, third largest reserves in the world of oil. And don't forget about uranium, 20% of that. I went down that laundry list already. And then in energy technology, whether it's CCS or clean coal or even what happens in habitat reclamation, we can have a better record. We should strive for better. But the way it is right now is pretty darn, it's a lot better than our competitors, I'll say that.
There have been times when the federal government was all gung-ho to push hard on that resource agenda, including grain and including sort of stuff that isn't petroleum. The Prime Minister made a trip to China that was very high-profile, but that's getting to be a long time ago. Do you think it's time to come back to that agenda at all?
I do, and there's a couple ways we can do it. I think the federal government has already moved on the competitiveness side, though it's a process, not an event. We should always be striving for competitive taxes and a regulatory regime. But we're getting back to balanced budget next year. The fiscal probity is part of how we get to exploit, to take advantage of our strength in energy and food. But here's an area where we can go harder. CETA was great. Credit the Prime Minister for that. Provinces are, and all the sectors were a lot of cats to herd to get us to that agreement. Feds did a great job on it. The Prime Minister was just leading on that file. Asia's got to be next because European population's declining over the next 50 years. Mm-hmm. Asia's increasing by 550 million. Their sluggish GDP rates are sevens. That's where the middle class is growing. They want protein-intense diets. That's lentils and peas and all the other food we have to offer. They're going to need energy. We have the next trade deal we have in Asia will be the first one. So South Korea, it looks like they're working on. We support that. And then let's not stop there. Let's look at multilateral with the ASEAN countries. Let's encourage the federal government to continue on the TPP front. Those trade deals are crucial. I congratulated the Prime Minister when CETA was negotiated, and I said, you know, this was historic, and what would even be more historic is a series of trade deals in Asia, and we'll be supportive of that in every way we can. Those aren't always easy. In South Korea, we know the auto sector situation comes into it, but we really just have to find a way to conclude agreements in that area of the world.
Is it time for Stephen Harper to go back to China?
Yeah, I think it's time for all of us to make that a regular occurrence, and even in Saskatchewan. And so I would never ask of the federal government what we're not prepared to do. We need to make sure that our own trade missions in Asia aren't itinerant. We sort of show up every now and then. We've been working hard to do it, but admittedly, I think it's been a couple, 3 years to China for us. And that's a huge market, as you can appreciate, for potash and some other, and agriculture. So the short answer is yes, but that's an answer that all of us should abide by.
You have to know that these conferences are family gatherings for the national conservative movement in this country. And a lot of people are kicking the tires on people they think might have a future in national political leadership. Do you ever think of changing jobs?
No, and I don't mean to be glib, Paul, but I do often say this to people. I say, really, Kenny and Prentice and Moore and maybe even the Prime Minister should be asked, when are you going to try to be the Premier of Saskatchewan? Because that's the best job in the country in terms of politics, in my view. And I'm not really being glib. I believe that. We have work to do, and I don't have any interest in federal politics, and I don't have the language requirements anyway.
Okay. That was going to be another question. How's your French?
Pas bien. It's not very good. I took it right up till second year university, and you know, I can watch a hockey game, but I'm not conversant, certainly, and I'm not taking lessons or any of those other things, and I just there's a lot of work to do in Saskatchewan, and not interested in federal politics.
I counted three or four veiled shots at Justin Trudeau. Have you met him, first of all, and is he a concern for conservatives in Canada?
You know, obviously he's the leader of the party that I think will be the main contender for federal office, for federal government to be the government after the next election. So, sure, he is. He's the leader of the party. I have talked to him, with him over the phone. There's some things I've seen that I've liked. I do like that he has come out in support of Kinder Morgan and the Keystone. But again, it's an issue of consistency. That's a hard position to take when you're lobbying U.S. senators and members of the House to approve Keystone, if they'll say, well, wait a minute, why not Gateway? And if the answer is, well, it kind of goes through sensitive areas of our country. Well, Keystone, you know, in any particular state, they'll show you areas they might think are sensitive. So we have to be consistent there. And I also do need, I understand I was an opposition politician, but within a year of being elected leader of the party, we had come up with an economic plan. And we had also come out, then later on, we redid our policies, and we were able to do to offer some specifics. I get in opposition politics, you're not going to get into your platform. But I do think it's fair to say whoever the opposition challenger is to the government, yes, you need to criticize the government. Yes, you need to talk in general ways about your vision. But you also need a little meat on the bone. We need to know some of the specifics so we can have the debate we need in this country about who's going to lead it.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to us once again.
Paul, thank you.
That's Premier Brad Wall with Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells.
The Manning Conference is aimed at looking at the current state of conservatism in Canada, but also where the movement is heading. The chair of the Manning Centre and former Cabinet Minister Chuck Strahl tells Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes about what this event means for Tories across Canada.
I think for the conservative movement, I think what the Manning Networking Conference, how it evolves will be interesting as the party comes and goes in and out of power. You know, what's clearly happening is this has become a go-to place, you know, in between elections where people can float ideas, you know, build some networks, do a lot of the kind of the grunt work of both election and policy development without the trappings of the partisan world. And so that's a great opportunity. And what will be interesting is, you know, we'll go into even for next election year. Like, is next election year going to be the biggest conference ever? Or will people say, I'm too tied up with the electioneering? You know, that's a little unknown. But what's happening, and you can see it even in the, you know, four or five opposition leaders that are here, people are using this as we had intended and hoped for, which is, you know, this isn't just about the feds, and it's not just about Ottawa, but it's about you know, like-minded people coming together and kicking around some pretty big ideas. And it's typical of Preston, of course, but it's typical of the people here, I think.
Well, one thing when I was talking to people in advance, I made some calls over the last couple of days, is keep coming back to the Justin Trudeau backdrop of politics right now. I mean, he touched on it just briefly, Brad Wall, in his speech this morning, you know, made a couple of jokes about Trudeau in the early going. Is it not a kind of nightmare for conservatives? I mean, it's one thing to be going in and out of power. That's sort of the natural cycle of politics. But for a lot of people in this room and people across the way on Parliament Hill, the idea of losing to a Trudeau must be like almost like the absolute worst case scenario. Does that change the stakes or the emotions or the level of commitment in politics on the conservative side of the spectrum these days?
I don't know. I mean, for half the people in this room, they may not even been alive when Pierre Elliott was alive, you know, or in power. So I don't know that it's as personal as that. I think that, you know, what concerns a crowd like this is the fear of the unknown. They don't know what Trudeau stands for yet. You know, they don't know that what they hear is a juxtaposition of the position that Brad took. Brad said, you should be proud of the country. You should, you know, we've got a great thing going. It's a wonderful thing to be Canadian, and it's you're in a you know, great country with a great opportunity. As opposed to a message that says, you're hard done by. It's getting worse for you. You should be alarmed. The middle class is disappearing. This is a travesty. That message doesn't resonate with this crowd.
That's the chair of the Manning Center and former Cabinet Minister Chuck Strahl.
All right, it's now time for the Maclean's panel with political editor Paul Wells, Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, and my co-host, associate editor Aaron Wary. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Well, we might as well start with the Manning Center conference since we're sitting right here, right now. It's bringing together many well-known conservatives, and there's been a lot of talk about four of them: Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall, Employment Minister Jason Kenney, Federal Industry Minister James Moore, and former Cabinet Minister Jim Prentice. So we have these four big names here at the conference. Is this sort of a preview for a potential leadership race? John, you were able to catch Brad Wall's speech this morning.
Well, if it is a preview, it's very interesting on a couple of fronts, at least in terms of the way Brad Wall presented himself. Good speech. The room really liked it. But a couple of things stuck out for me. He spent a lot of time framing the debate in Canadian life these days as being between people who believe in resource development as a sort of backbone of Canada's future prosperity and people who don't believe in it. And when I heard that, I couldn't help thinking, isn't that an old battle for conservatives to be fighting? I mean, I think they must believe they have strongholds in the parts of the country where people are mostly worried about resource development. It didn't sound to me like a message that would resonate terribly well with people in, let's say, the battleground suburbs of Vancouver or Toronto or some of the other places where the Tories must be hoping to sort of shore themselves up. So if Brad Wall was thinking about sort of long-term prospects for electoral breakthroughs and new constituencies and coalitions on the sort of right of the political spectrum in Canada, he seemed not to be talking about that. He seemed to be more talking to the room. That's at least how it sounded to me.
So, Paul, is campaigning actually underway, or are all the headlines in the newspapers sort of blowing this out of proportion?
I asked some conservatives around at this conference whether the job is open or will be open soon. And there's a little difference of opinion, but the strong consensus is that no, that Stephen Harper will lead the party into the next election, has a shot at winning it, and that these won't be clear and present concerns for the Conservative Party for a few more years. But in the meantime, everyone is kicking the tires. They talk about these speeches as though they were campaign speeches. Brad Wall remains, I think, sort of the gold standard of potential one-day future candidates. And this may come as a surprise. I'm always surprised to learn that people outside of Ottawa haven't heard of this notion that the Saskatchewan Premier might wind up leading the Conservative Party. But it's all conservatives talk about among themselves. And I heard the speech that James Moore gave. And he's the industry minister, but he sure is interested in talking about heritage, which is his former portfolio. And to the extent that he's campaigning, if I can assert that he's campaigning, he's campaigning as Sir John A. Macdonald. Instead of a railway, he wants to build an internet trunk into every home in the country. He talks a lot about how the provinces don't teach education and that the federal government don't teach history, and that the federal government must find ways to get a knowledge of history spread among the population. It was a very interventionist, somewhat red Tory message, and I'll tell you, the room didn't have an awful lot of people in it, but most of the people that I recognized are on the red Tory end of the party.
And Aaron, we have Jim Prentice here. Does he have a disadvantage since he's not holding political office at this time, or do his connections from when he was a cabinet minister still hold over, and does he have to increase his presence by attending more events like this?
I suspect he still has a certain amount of status. I think the question with Mr. Prentice is sort of the question that has come up with people like Frank McKenna and other people on the Liberal side, which is once you've gone to private life, what's the incentive to get back into public life exactly? Unless it's a clear shot, unless it looks like you can sweep back to power, it's maybe not worth getting back in.
So let's switch gears here and look at the conservative enemy, Justin Trudeau, definitely one person that every Tory wants to take down. How do you think Trudeau plays a factor at this conference?
I think just the fact, there's two factors, right? There's the historical one and the present danger one. The present danger one is that Trudeau's been leading the polls now since he became Liberal leader. That just can't be ignored. It's a sustained threat to the party's power, the Conservative Party's power. But the historical element of it is probably more interesting to me. Many of the older people in this room really came into conservatism at a time when hating Trudeau was the hallmark of being a sort of red-blooded Tory in this country, a conservative or eventually a reformer. It was a big, big part of that identity. And the notion, it's almost an incredible nightmare scenario, the notion that they would only a generation later find themselves in a position where they might conceivably lose to this guy again. It's an astonishingly strange turn of events, and it's probably a more of a deeply felt personal thing for older conservatives, frankly, than for younger people who don't really remember Pierre Elliott Trudeau very well.
All right, and you spoke about generations of Trudeaus. Oddly enough, during this conference, Justin Trudeau has a baby, little Hadrian, who was brought into this world. But Paul, are conservatives here at the conference trying to establish a strategy to deal with the popularity of Trudeau and, as Strahl put it, the fear of the unknown?
They're more testing out lines. I was struck Brad Wall made two inside jokes at his keynote speech that you could only have understood if you are following every move that Justin Trudeau makes, and he got a pretty good laugh out of the crowd. They pay almost obsessive attention to what the guy says. And they would say, with some justice, that so do we. When you say, is the conservative movement testing out a strategy or trying to form a strategy? I mean, the great thing about these Manning conferences is this is not the Conservative Party. This is not any kind of cohesive, organized thing. I met a prominent Ottawa area Liberal who comes here. She says she comes to all these conferences just because it's her only chance to hear what conservatives are saying without any kind of media or filter, and not in a sort of a know thine enemy way, but just out of curiosity. This is the conservative movement with no ranks and with badges and pistols on the table instead of on people's hips. And that's what makes it, I speak for myself, but I don't think only for myself, an annual pleasure to cover.
And Aaron, Trudeau's been a target for the Conservatives this week because, once again, he has said something that he's later had to retract or explain away, and the Conservatives are saying it's a lack of judgment. Of course, it's on the issue in the Ukraine with his comments on Russia and making light of it, talking about losing an Olympic hockey. How much does that take Trudeau down in terms of popularity? Will it have an effect, or is it just more ammunition for the Conservatives moving forward?
I think it's obviously more ammunition, and I think Mr. Trudeau has obviously given them a fair amount of ammunition at times. I think they're sort of driving themselves, the Conservatives, I mean, are driving themselves a bit to distraction. I believe one of Mr. Wall's inside jokes may have been this idea, some comment Mr. Trudeau made about the budget, that I think you really have to, turn your head sideways to turn it into a gaffe. But I think that the problems for the Conservatives right now are, one, it's not clear that periodic gaffes by Justin Trudeau are enough to hurt his popularity with the people who like him. And two, if you set up the idea that Justin Trudeau is a goof, you give him a fairly low bar to get over. And so he has the next year and the 2015 campaign to not look like a goof. And that's, you know, shouldn't be that hard to get past. Now, maybe he will look like a goof and your narrative will be redeemed. But if he at all looks serious, if he at all looks like not quite the goof that you've made him out to be, then he wins that battle, I think.
Political editor Paul Wells, Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, and of course my co-host and associate editor Aaron Wherry, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Cormac.
Coming up, we take a look at the Rob Ford Circus at the Big City Mayor's Meeting in Ottawa.
On Wednesday, mayors from Canada's largest cities gathered in Ottawa for the Big City Mayors Meeting to discuss ways to get more federal funding for infrastructure projects and affordable housing. But for the first time in his tenure as mayor, Rob Ford decided to show up for the meeting. The media circus ensued.
He signed autographs, took pictures, ducked out in the middle of the meeting to go to a brew pub for lunch, and addressed his problems with drugs and alcohol.
We went out, and yeah, I did drink, but no, I have not done drugs since, I said, probably a year ago. And I don't. Maybe I wasn't quite clear with Matt, and I'm not here to offend the Canadian media, but I'm not going to sit here and get browbeaten for the mistakes that I've made. I've made mistakes. We've all made mistakes in this room, but you got to carry on, and that's what I'm doing.
To talk about the Ford sideshow and the actual work being done at the mayor's meeting, I'm joined now by Calgary Mayor Nahed Nenshi.
So all the mayors get together, the big city mayors, to try and deal with some serious issues focused around infrastructure mainly in their cities. And you're subject to this sideshow that is Rob Ford.
But let's be clear, there really wasn't much of a sideshow. You know, certainly there was big scrums outside of the meeting room, but there's always big scrums outside of the meeting room. The questions may have been a little bit different, but really, it was business as usual, and inside the room, it was fully business as usual. So I think the only people distracted by the sideshow were the folks in the media.
So inside the meeting, you guys were not distracted by anything that was going on outside of the meeting?
Not a bit. At least I wasn't, and I was sitting next to the guy.
Was he constructive in the meeting? Did he help and give some perspective for the other mayors?
Absolutely. Just like every mayor, he told us what was going on in his city. He spoke with some real passion about the needs in his city around social housing and the need for the federal government to step up. Interestingly, each of his interventions required the federal government to spend more money. I thought that was interesting.
This is something that you were going after. The FCM has been asking the federal government for more money for infrastructure and social housing.
I want to be clear. I don't like it when people say that the cities are asking for money. Let's remember where that money comes from. It comes from taxpayers who live in cities. In the city of Calgary, for example, city of Calgary taxpayers send $10 billion a year to the federal government, more than we receive in all federal services. The real gap in this country, if you like, is between the municipal order of government and other orders of government. So my entire budget is $3 billion a year. Taxpayers in my city send the feds $10 billion a year, more than we get back in all services. And if we don't invest in the cities where those taxpayers live, well, guess what? They're not going to live there anymore. And those great jobs are going to move offshore. So we're not asking for a handout. We're asking for a small tax rebate.
And were you satisfied with what you heard from the federal minister? Because we spoke to her afterwards, and it didn't seem like she arrived with any deliverables for the mayors, nor any commitment to deliver in the future.
No, of course not. And that was never the goal. This government is focused on reducing the deficits in advance of some event that's going to happen in 2015 that might be marginally interesting. So we weren't expecting any long-term commitments because this is, after all, the government in the last year of its mandate. However, the good news is about the meeting with the minister is that she did seem to understand the issue. And let me be clear on what that issue is. Starting next year, federal government initiatives that impact housing start to expire. And as those arrangements expire, that means some 500,000 affordable housing units across this country are at risk. In Calgary alone, of the 6,500 units that are run by the Calgary Housing Company, 5,000 out of 6,500 are subject to these expiring agreements. We've been warning the federal government about this coming tsunami since I've been mayor, and finally, the federal government has realized this is actually happening, and they've got to do something about it. And so I was happy to hear the minister say, okay, we're not going to get rid of any of this money. We might figure out ways to deploy it more efficiently. Certainly cities are happy with that. But not only do we have a lot of old social housing that needs, that is in desperate need of repair, but we've got giant waiting lists across this entire country for more social housing, whether delivered by government, nonprofit agencies, or the private sector. And the federal government plays an absolutely key role in that. So I'm glad that the minister understands that. The question is what she could do about it.
And we asked her about that, specifically about that funding, and her analogy was, hey, listen, we all pay mortgages, and sometimes mortgages expire, like a loan. She didn't really seem to be giving off any indication that she was going to take further action on this in the future, and didn't answer some of those questions while walking away from us. Do you have any confidence whatsoever that that the federal government will follow through?
I'm not sure whether the minister is herself a homeowner. But if that is her attitude, I would be scared to look at the state of her roof. Because, of course, in addition to paying your mortgage, you got to do maintenance. You got to keep your place up. And if she's not doing that on her roof, then she may find herself very wet one day. And that's really the situation that we've got here. And hopefully the federal government understands that. We also met with the brand new CEO of CMHC, the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. And I must say, he seem to understand the problem.
Now, one of the other issues that that was coming up was also infrastructure funding. Did you get anywhere on that with the federal government? Is that something that, that came up?
Not at all. Canada remains the only country in the G7 that lacks a national funding strategy for transit. The only country in the G7 where the federal government funds transit only on an ad hoc basis, you know, going out $600 billion for the Toronto subway, coming out of nowhere in particular, but not look at the transit needs of the big cities. One of the biggest problems in the recently announced Building Canada Fund is there's a special program for small and rural communities, which is great, good for them. But there's no commensurate special program for big cities. And the moment that you have rail infrastructure in transit, whether LRT or subway, the moment you have that, your cost structure completely changes, and you need significantly more cash in order to build the stuff, though less cash to operate it. And there is no recognition whatsoever by the federal government that these needs are different and that they're the same for every big city. And I'm hopeful that, I remain eternally hopeful, that they will realize their error here.
How big is the infrastructure deficit? Canadians may not have an idea of the issues that are surrounding this, for especially for cities who have to deal with these problems on a day-to-day basis.
In Calgary alone, we are looking at, for transit alone, a $12 billion gap. And remember, this is a city that has a $3 billion annual operating budget, so that's four times my annual budget for transit alone. When we take in roads, and social infrastructure like fire halls and parks and so on, then the total infrastructure and deficit in Calgary over time is approaching $30 billion, or 10 times my annual budget. It's impossible to conceive of paying for that through the property tax, which is the only source of revenue that cities have. So we need that tax rebate from the federal government.
What happens if you don't get that in the next few years? You don't get commitments to help address these issues?
The issue here is that congestion robs people of the quality of their life. It's bad for the environment, and people end up spending enormous amounts of time in traffic. So, yes, we're seeing sporadic transit investments across the country. Kitchener-Waterloo is getting an LRT. We are building up transitways in Calgary. Of course, Toronto is building subway and LRT, but these are sporadic and small. And what we need is a long-term commitment that will last a decade or more to start building out the transit in our largest cities, all of it, to really start addressing the issue of congestion and giving people back that time and that quality of life.
Otherwise, they end up paying more?
Well, you know, otherwise we end up paying more. We end up losing tons of economic productivity. people start wanting to leave our city because we lose the advantage of quality of life. And in this increasingly mobile world, if I'm an employer whose employees just can't get to work on time, well, what's my advantage for staying in Calgary and not going to Houston or Shanghai or Dubai?
That's Calgary Mayor Nahed Nenshi discussing the big city mayor's meeting, Rob Ford, and the push for more housing and infrastructure dollars from the federal government.
Coming up, question period in review. Once again, thanks for joining us at the Manning Center Conference in Ottawa. And now it's time for our question period in review. We're joined by the host of QP Live on Macleans.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, who takes a look back at all the action on the floor of the House of Commons this week.
The opposition spent much of last year united in its pursuit of answers over the Senate expenses scandal. Not so this year, as the NDP has spent weeks attacking the government's proposed electoral reform as the Liberals have honed in on the plight of the middle class. It's a clean divide on the opposition side, and it's forcing the Tories into a two-front war. Here's Mulcair on Monday, setting the tone for the week.
Conservatives have said that public hearings on the Unfair Elections Act would be, quote, a gong show and a circus. But Conservatives supported the unelected Senate holding public hearings outside of Ottawa 25 times in the last year. Now, what do Conservatives think that consultations by the unelected Senate makes them vital, whereas letting Canadians speak to their members of Parliament is somehow a gong show? Why contempt for Canadians? Why contempt for democracy? There you go.
On Tuesday, the Prime Minister made it look easy as he squared off against Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. He even turned a verbal slip into a joke at the opposition's expense.
Mr. Speaker, I'm glad to see, though, the NDP, or the Liberal Party is interested. I got confused over the weekend.
Stephen Harper's cheery mood extended to Wednesday when he neutralized Mulcair's lead question with relative ease.
Mr. Speaker, last week, the Member of Parliament for Nepean Carlton had an unelected senator who is deeply involved in the Wright Duffy Senate expense scandal headline for him at a fundraiser. Is this what the Prime Minister expects of his Minister of Democratic Reform?
There you go. The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
I think the Minister of Democratic Reform is doing an excellent job.
Thursday's most extraordinary moment featured NDP Deputy Leader Megan Leslie. She was pleading with the government to take action on violence against women in the aftermath of the slaying of Loretta Saunders. Such genuine emotion is rare in the House of Commons, a chamber usually overflowing with manufactured anger, not the heartfelt cry for justice that Leslie delivered.
Loretta Saunders was writing her university thesis on missing and murdered Indigenous women when she went missing herself. And today our community mourns. Over 800 Indigenous women have been murdered or gone missing since 1990, and it's time for us to acknowledge this crisis and for us to act. So will the government establish a national action plan on violence against women?
This week, the opposition mostly failed to wrench the government from its talking points, whether on electoral reform or the Conservative economic record. The tone during QP these days sure is a far cry from last year's showdowns over Senate expenses.
Once again, with Question Period Interview, that's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thank you to Macleans foreign correspondent Michael Petru, Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall, Chair of the Manning Centre Chuck Strahl, and Calgary Mayor Nahed Nenshi. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.